Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy,
presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
Remember when Republicans vowed to run government like a business if they ever got in charge at Northeast 23rd and Lincoln Boulevard? The implication was, unlike free-spending Democrats, GOPers would squeeze every penny, ensuring taxpayers got way more bang for their bucks. In the two decades since they seized the state house levers of power, Republicans have run government like a business, but not in the ways you might think. While state employees remain underpaid and their salaries stagnant, state agency chiefs' compensation has skyrocketed, especially since the legislature ceded power to Governor Kevin Stitt to hire and fire major state agency CEOs at will. In fiscal year 2025 alone, the Office of Management and Enterprise Services reported, 18 state agency chief executive officers received pay increases of at least 10%, including paying an eye-popping 112% more to Department of Commerce leader John Budd than was paid to his predecessor, $300,000 compared to his predecessor's $141,000. That follows the American corporate playbook, where CEOs were paid 281 times as much as the typical worker in 2024. That's up from 21 times as much as the typical worker in 1965, according to the Economic Policy Institute. Moreover, top CEO compensation soared 1,094% from 1978 to 2024, compared to just 26% during that same period for a typical worker's compensation. Is this what Oklahoma taxpayers thought they would be getting from the run government like a business crowd? State Representative Andy Fugate thinks not. The Del City Democrat joins us for our latest ObserverCast to break down the unconscionable salary increases and what the run government like a business agenda has meant for the delivery of state services that so many Sooners rely on.
Hi, welcome. We're happy to be here on this kind of dreary Saturday afternoon, but we're so honored to have Representative Andy Fugate with us this morning. So as we always kick it off, we've had you many times on here and it's always a pleasure, but tell us who you are and what you do.
So I am Andy Fugate. I am the elected representative for my hometown, which is Del City, and the surrounding community that other people call South Oklahoma City, and I refer to as the suburbs of Del City. I have been there since 2019, and in 2021 was appointed as the floor leader for the House Democrats, and so I remain today as the floor leader. People ask me about that all the time. So what does floor leader mean? And I just basically sum it up as I help everybody else with their homework. And I was that kid in school. I'm the guy that knows all about the rules. And if somebody's trying to figure out how they need to get an amendment, move through the process, all of those kinds of things, as well as keeping my thumb on the pulse of policy for the caucus as best I can. It's tough with 5,200 bills in play. So
no kidding.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Well, the reason we asked you back is because we have, and you've been at the forefront of bringing this to the public's attention, but we have learned some interesting things about Republican supermajority governance at the state capitol with regard to the heads of our state agencies and what they're being paid. And I'm not sure that enough people are aware of this. And I'd like to for us to jump in and talk about how it is that we have reached a point where this last year, according to the Office of Management and Enterprise Services, we had 18 of our agency CEOs who were given pay raises of 10% or more that year. Some as high as 112% in the case of John Budd at the Department of Commerce. And all of a sudden, these state agencies on the taxpayer dime are being led by individuals who are making enormous salaries, while our state employees who are doing the real work are not. They're paid less than half of what, you know, public sector workers are paid. So, Andy, this is in your wheelhouse because you've studied this closely. So I wondered if you might sort of give us a primer here on what happened and why it is so outrageous beyond what I've already said.
Boy, there's a lot in all of this. I'll say that I may have lit the fuse on this. It was not by intentional research. I was actually pursuing another subject and happened to run across a couple of years ago, the legislature produced a mandate for OMES to produce an annual report recapping significant salary increases for agency directors. I don't think of them as CEOs. You know, right. The kind of
kind of work, a misnomer for what they do.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. But as I looked at the most recent report, I thought, holy smokes, how did this happen? Where we have one agency head who goes from 141,000, and that's the salary they were offered when they were appointed, to a $300,000 salary. What was it that they were doing that, you know, changed so radically that required them to be paid like that? We had another individual. And so I went and looked at the previous year who received two pay raises. They went from 140 to 160, and then from 160 to 220, no, 237,500. Just enormous pay raises. And I looked at the numbers respectfully. These are people that I think of as the Kevin Stitt Bro Club. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, these outrageous salaries can be tied directly back to the governor's office. And the governor saying, this is how much you should pay these people.
Well, go ahead, Marianne.
So let's dive into that just a little bit more, because this is, I was hoping we'd go this direction, because these are not new hires.
Correct.
And these are not hires from private sector that were in, you know, like the same industry that were lured to the public sector by salary.
Yes.
These are the same half a dozen individuals.
Yeah.
That have worked for Governor Stitt in some capacity his entire administration.
I'll say that not all of them have been part of his coterie. From
but John
day
Budd
one.
Certainly has.
Yes,
officially at least.
Well, I was thinking about the former head of tourism who's now gone, who originally started out as a PIO for OMES. Yeah, mm-hmm. Then goes to OESC, winds up in trouble there because of some a contract that benefited her family.
I thought that was at tourism that happened.
That may,
because she went from OESC to tourism.
Yeah, the contract was with a computer company that I thought was involved in COVID.
Her spouse's, yeah, it was her,
yes,
spouse's contract. Yeah, and I know too much about this individual. So, but yeah, no. To your point, though, she's not there anymore. She's been banned from the public sector for a certain amount of time because of her unethical self-dealing.
Correct. Yeah. That may be one that's not necessarily part of that inner circle. At least didn't come in that way, but certainly worked their way into. Yes. Saw the same thing at Department of Corrections. Yeehaw. And you know, it's just all over the place. If you are part of Kevin Stitt's club, then you're going to get all the benefits. And it's really heartbreaking when, Arnold, you pointed this out, I think, in your initial remarks, the average salary comparison for state employees, they're making just 48 cents on the dollar in the market studies that have been done.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a governor who's telling all of these agencies, I want you to produce flat budgets, right? Mm-hmm. Even though we still have inflation, And cost of living in Oklahoma is rising dramatically. But the governor is not interested in the rank and file. It's just those at the top, the elites. It's like everything else in the state economy. It's the 1% who are making out like gangbusters, and the rest of us, 99%, we just aren't.
So it just occurred to me too, like I kind of wanted to open up kind of our view on who all is involved in this as well, because, you know, I once had ties to the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, which is a state Medicaid agency, for those who don't know and don't remember us talking about it before. You know, but I was a part of a contingent of folks that were removed from our positions at OHCA for him to, when Governor Stitt took charge of the agency, put in a man who had no healthcare experience at all to run the agency. And that individual ultimately left. His chief of staff then became, say, agency director. She just recently left, and now she is the president of Rogers State, I believe. She's now the president of one of our smaller system universities.
Plum appointment again.
Exactly. So it's not like they have to go far. They may not be like in, you know, the actual, like, you know, umbrella agencies, but I mean, they are certainly circulating throughout the state in these really, really handsomely paid positions. But that bounce from, because I distinctly remember like 143 was like the top salary for an agency director.
Yeah, there was a point in time when the governor's salary, and at least in terms of executive office salaries, was right at the top.
Right, but I mean, but it was only $143,000, right?
Yeah. You know? 147, I think. But yeah, whatever the number is.
Right, it was like within that range, and then so mm-hmm. to increase it to 300,000 without any other adjustment to the, you know, the salary bands underneath it, is just outrageous.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, a couple of things. One, this is not something new for this administration. I raised heck about this when I was first elected as a freshman, because the first thing that Kevin Stitt did when he came in was double the requested budget for his own staff.
I was actually thinking about that too, because I remember talking to someone at one of the associations, and they were like, he's going to blow through his office's budget in no time. It's only what, like $1.4 million, and he's just going to blow right through it. And sure enough.
I asked the question, how is it that we can be doubling his salary, or the salary for his direct reports? And they said, well, you know, Mary Fallon just wasn't paying her employees an appropriate amount. Well, she was doing just fine, at least by comparison to this governor. And that's,
well, I'm also going to say too, so his general counsel, Jeffrey Cartmeal, is now over at Service Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Like every people who started in his office or one of his agency hires, cabinet hires, I mean, they have slowly come to take over these agencies across the board, whether or not they were qualified for it.
Yeah. Whether their experience or expertise aligns really doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's their loyalty to the governor. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's absolutely the wrong metric for putting anybody into any of these positions.
Well, and another reason why the taxpayers are paying a price for the legislature ceding so much authority to the governor over the years, it seems to me. And this highlights, as few other things do, in ways that I think people can understand, the wisdom of Oklahoma's founders, who set up the system to try to make sure that we didn't concentrate too much power in too few hands. And, you know, the voters, if anyone was paying the least attention, nobody should be surprised by what we've seen with the hires from Governor Stitt. This was a guy whose mortgage business was banned from doing business in how many states? Mm-hmm. I don't know, 9, 10, 11, I'd lost track. But, you know, they were all kinds of funny business was going on at the time. And this is a guy who plays fast and loose with the rules, as best I can see. The problem on top of this is not only costing the taxpayers all this money in salary boosts all of a sudden, but these folks are doing real damage, right, to the state agencies and to the services that everyday Oklahomans rely on.
Right.
Agreed.
I mean, they just simply don't know how to do their job. They simply don't understand the subject area of the agencies in which they're in charge.
Yeah. And I'm not going to say these people are not smart people. They're not people who are well-intentioned, but you know, without direct understanding of the stuff that they're supposed to be overseeing, they're making respectfully rookie mistakes. And those mistakes hurt 4 million Oklahomans every time one of those things happens. And you know, that maybe one of the other pernicious effects of the changes that the legislature has been making, at least in the now 8 years that I've been in the legislature, is this belief that we have to have a direct hire and fire by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a time in our history, and I really point back to before 2011, that to me was kind of the defining point where this started happening, but the governor didn't have the authority to go in and wholesale replace a board, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wound up with longevity on that board and a thoughtful process where you were trying to decide who would show up on a board because you knew that person was going to be there 6 years, 7 years, 8 years. And beginning in 2011, when Janet Barisi threw a fit because she could not hire a person that she wanted to hire because the state board of education said, no, you won't do that. The legislature in its infinite stupidity gave the governor the ability to fire everybody on the board and replace them at will. And that became a revolving extension of whatever the governor wanted to have done in terms of education policy. And that has since happened at tourism. And we saw the mess that happened at tourism. Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, where the governor dismissed the doctors from the healthcare authority board and replaced them with show ponies. You know, we put somebody in charge, the governor put somebody in charge of the State Department of Health who had no health degree. He's an attorney. And then we had to create a almost $500,000 advisory position who did have a medical degree to help make sure he was making the correct decisions. And that didn't used to happen because you had experience and expertise required on these boards. And it was the boards who made the decisions policy wise, not the agency head. And so the boards, frankly, were the ones who hired agency heads. It was not the governor who did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of direct manipulation by the governor has been toxic. And it's a fundamental reason why I think we have basic problems. Like I can't go down and get a driver's license and, you know, walk out with one. I have to wait 6 weeks. I get a little piece of paper. I can walk around and say, look, I'm waiting for my driver's license. Can I use this to write a check? No. Can I use this to vote? No. Can I use? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the Republican takeover of the Oklahoma legislature was built largely on this notion that they would run government like a business, as we discussed, that government was inefficient. It was full of, you know, ne'er-do-wells who weren't doing hard work and political appointees and, you know, and all that sort of thing. They were going to fix all this stuff. And in fact, you know, by shifting the power here, they've made things, it seems, much worse. So the question becomes, when do the taxpayers begin to understand what has happened here and begin to make changes again and make demands of their elected leaders to stop this nonsense and sort of restore the checks and balances that are desperately needed to make sure that these agencies... I really think most people looking back now, if you think about it, or if you've had much reason to interact with state agencies, would largely say that they were not perfect, but they were running pretty efficiently previously, and they're not now.
Well, I think that's rose-colored glasses thinking. The people I talk to would probably tell you they never thought government worked.
Well, so this just reinforces the thinking.
Yeah.
So what do you do about it? I mean, you can't, you know, you got to have government. You can't throw baby out with the bathwater entirely, but.
You know, one of the things you said something that is a trigger word for me, you know, the Republicans took over and they were going to manage government more efficiently. And to me, that's the absolute wrong metric. You know, the old saying is you always get what you measure. And if I'm measuring efficiency, what I wind up with is a turnpike where one third of the people who drive on the turnpike will never pay for it because they can't find them, identify them, bill them correctly. Right. And now, instead of paying $4 to go to Tulsa, it costs $10 to go to Tulsa. Is it more efficient? Yes. Is it more effective? No. And to me, that's the word we ought to be using when we measure government. Is this doing it effectively? It's more efficient to give money to these third party crisis pregnancy network organizations and let them administer it, to give grants to organizations that are supposed to be helping unwed mothers have their babies. But is it more effective? No, because we had an audit that was done 4 years ago now, 3 years, 4 years, I don't remember which, that showed 95% or 90% of the dollars were not making it down to the organizations that were actually helping women. They were staying with the parent organization that's supposed to be doing grants and going into the pockets of those people who were running the organization.
And that's not an isolated case.
No. And it's frustrating because it is taxpayer dollars. They're just being handed over in wheelbarrows. And we don't have any transparency or accountability measures in place to make sure that stuff is actually working correctly. We just give these big bags of money and say, here, go administer this for us. You know, I requested legislation, maybe it's 4 years ago now, that dealt with this issue of, I refer to as government by extension, right? That basically said, if we're going to take an existing government function and outsource it, whomever we outsource it to should also be subject to the same transparency and accountability measures as if the government were doing it themselves. Otherwise, you're putting this veil up and just throwing money over to the other side of it.
Well, and we've seen through so many cases, and you know, including the, you know, sort of the COVID era is one of the great examples of just sort of
class wallet, classroom wallet, or whatever it was.
Class wallet,
Epic.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, to know that the auditor's office, you know, Cindy Bird's office, is not nearly staffed enough, right? And then this is by design. You know, like our oversight mechanisms by design are understaffed and under-resourced, you know, OTC, like all these groups, you know, the treasurer's office, all these groups where we could have these safeguards in place, like they are not, you know, these massive bureaucracies. But I mean, I also say too, like, bureaucracy is created for a reason, right? And so like the things because I've heard Sid talk about this too, and it absolutely drives me wild. Like there are contracting and procurement practices for a reason. You know, and all these no bid contracts, right? Or all these like mysterious, like, how did that happen? Like, how did they redesign this website with a no bid? Like, all these, I mean, there are bidding and RFP processes for a reason, because of people like STIT, you know? So these multi-million dollar contracts from state agencies for, you know, kind of dubious purposes. That sidestep procurement and contracting, like, protocol, right? Like,
yes,
because they go terribly wrong.
there's a couple of things involved in that. You know, the formation of OMES by all the daughter organizations, agencies that kind of all got lumped together, Office of State Finance being one, meant that you no longer had focus on those individual agencies. And as a result, procurement kind of went under the radar. When Kevin Stitt is elected, we started putting people in place over there that began to do some goofy things with our state procurement process. And in the midst of COVID, they created what was effectively a preferred list of vendors. And you could go shop off with a preferred list of vendors, whether or not, you know, normally you would have to do some kind of an RFP and go out full bid, everything else. No, you could just go over and engage services, even though you may have been getting them for two or three times what you would have paid if you went through the RFP. But that preferred vendor process, which, by the way, there are many of us who don't believe that was statutory at all. But when you have an attorney general who's appointed by the governor to fill a position, right? So they're kind of in lockstep with each other. You wind up with a position that's not inclined to go prosecute or change something that is, I won't say criminal, that's a strong word to use, but certainly not the way the process was intended. I am blessed to say that I am a member of, I think of us as a cabal, headed up by Judd Strom. You know, Judd's a very conservative Republican who is as passionate about good government as I am. And he has worked closely, all of us, with the state auditor's office. And we have a package, 8 bills that we will be presenting and hopefully getting all the way to the governor's desk. Wouldn't surprise me if he vetoed all 8. but all about how we overhaul and put up curbs so that we don't drive off of the cliffs when people are making purchasing decisions. Mm-hmm. The number of exemptions that we have created that allow agencies to go spend $150,000, $200,000, the number of places where one person has to sign off on something and that's it, all of that stuff needs to go away.
I just wonder, you know, I wonder how much of this, well, no. So, you know, go back to the big crisis at the health department. So many years ago, whenever that was,
Mary Fallon. Yeah.
Yeah. So we lost
$30 million. Didn't know where it was.
Well, and it's, well, one, you know, it was what related to antiquated accounting software, right?
So and not knowing how that worked.
Well, and it was like, they were trying to keep money from being swept from the agency. And so they were putting it in other accounts and forgetting that they had done that. Right.
Yeah.
But
effectively, so, it was a set of spreadsheets that was keeping track of all this stuff.
Because that's how they did it. Like,
yes,
five years ago, the healthcare authority used Excel,
yeah,
to do their accounting because they did not have access to the software that needed to manage the billions of dollars in billing that they dealt with all the time. Like, I my ex-husband is an accountant, and I just remember telling him that, and he was like, "They what?" Like. Like just really antiquated because they could not get the money that they could not get the contracts as they actually needed to use best practices to do things like general accounting for these multi-billion dollar agencies. But then also you just see like agencies going into defensive mode, right? Where they're like trying, because they don't have anyone at the state level or, you know, in the governor's office that understands what they do. And so they're starting to do underhanded things. It's just like, it has led to kind of like this snowballing, like you said, lack of effectiveness, right? Ineffectiveness. But now there's not even that institutional knowledge. Yes. You know, because like how many people at the State Department of Education have to be rehired now?
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that can never mind that federal policy is just not what it was. Right. But just like the people that could actually maneuver and navigate through federal policy and on top of state policy. How about the healthcare authority? Right. Now that it's outsourced, I knew everybody that was in charge of the programs throughout the healthcare authority. None of them are there anymore. And they were experts in like they were so well regarded. It wasn't just at the state level. Nationally, people respected our agency.
Yeah. The administrative burden when I came in within OHCA was under 4%.
Mm-hmm.
And the average turnaround time for payments back to those Medicare
or
Medicaid providers.
Every week.
Less than 7 days.
They paid the providers. Mm-hmm.
Now it's 60 days, 90 days, 120 days. And yeah.
Yep. Yep. And so, I mean, just the institutional knowledge. I mean, I remember the boards that just all the agencies that would sit on the various boards for their sister agencies, just like the knowledge, the decades and decades of knowledge that they had of policy, of procedure, of just best practices, of, everything that they did, like all that is gone now.
Yeah. Why we do things this way? What's the
Why we do
impact?
things.
Yeah.
But
And
I mean,
or we did
bureaucracy
this.
exists for a reason.
Yeah. You see that so much. Well, to me, perfect example of this. Here we are in the legislature, again, in our infinite stupidity. 1997, the state created the Reading Sufficiency Act.
Oh.
It was intended to identify kids below the third grades, kindergarten through third grade, who were struggling with reading and to provide them with additional supports so that they could come up to grade level and be prepared by the time they got to fourth grade. And generally speaking, it was doing that. Fast forward to 2011, and we decided to turn it into a punishment. And we
Yes.
said, the legislature said, if you can't pass a third grade reading test, we're going to hold you in the third grade until you can. So you're 27, 28, 30 years old, and you finally can pass a third grade reading. There's, that's obviously hyperbole, but there's a funny, in my mind, episode of the cartoon show Family Guy, where the father of the family, Peter, finally graduates third grade, and he's like 40 years old. And it makes me think of that. But so in 2011, we changed the law. We made it punitive and said, we're going to hold you back. Doesn't matter about the support side of it and making sure we're helping you learn to read. We're just going to test you. And if you can't read, we're going to hold you back. The first group we did was 2014, where that actually happened. 2 years ago, the legislature finally changed its mind and said, you know what? We're going to return RSA back to its roots. We're going to look for kids who are struggling with reading. We're going to get them all the support they need to come up to speed with their grade level peers. What are we doing this year? We're going to put it back to punitive. We had 1 year where we saw really good results. It was 2015. So the first year after we put the retention in place, and that kind of makes sense. You're only passing on kids to the fourth grade who can take and pass the fourth grade reading test. But if you follow that same cohort of kids to the eighth grade when they were tested 4 years later, no measurable difference, none. The only difference was they were a year older.
So, I'm going to add something to that because my daughter was actually. So when we moved to Oklahoma, my two oldest kids started school in Texas, and my second daughter had had a stroke and had cerebral palsy. And by the time we moved back to Oklahoma, she was just getting school age to kind of figure out all the ways that her stroke had like impacted cognition and her academics and stuff. Well, anyway, so I knew this third grade Reading Sufficiency Act was staring at us because she wasn't retaining sight words. So I had to go on my own and figure out what was going on. Luckily had the capacity and a boss who would let me take work time to like figure this out. Lo and behold, we get a dyslexia diagnosis. Couldn't get that through the schools. If we had still been in Texas, she would have been diagnosed in schools and would have received the remediation that the reading specialist that she needed. In Oklahoma, they thought she just needed to keep reading in groups out loud and that she would eventually get there. But yeah, we were staring at that third grade reading retention because, but no one at the school was properly equipped to help us. The state, the laws hadn't like caught up with it at all. Dyslexia still wasn't recognized anywhere. It was actually Charles McCall who spearheaded it because he had a child with dyslexia, and so that's the only reason why there was a dyslexia task group. But all of this is to say, you see this turnover and you see these people with these buzzwords, and they've got to be able to read. Yes, they've got to be able to read. But if we were in Texas, she would have that reading specialist who could actually like retrain her brain so she could read as a dyslexic.
Yes.
Oh, and by the way, it's something like almost half of people in prison have are dyslexic. Like there are astronomical rates of people in the who are incarcerated that can't read because they have a learning disability. And our state's just not equipped for that. So going back to our conversation, right? I'm just going to say something. A friend of mine who worked with Teach for America for a really long time, and she's like, there is profit in failure. So you have your friends in the legislature who are returning back to these really punitive ways that don't actually go at the heart of why kids can't read. It may not be the teachers, but our teachers, I can tell you, still aren't being trained how to identify students with reading disorders. Okay. But all this is to say is like, it makes you can make someone a lot more money. A lot more money to say people are failing at something. Just like you can say the healthcare authority is a lot more profitable for somebody when it needs to be reformed, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, it's just.
I do want to sidebar a little bit and say that, you know, oftentimes the challenge with identifying those who are having reading differences and reading challenges, those things can be identified by a teacher who's been teaching 15, 20, 25 years.
Did you had teachers that were like 20, 30, 40 year teachers and they still didn't know she had dyslexia?
Okay. Well, my wife was one of those who routinely was identifying kids who had dyslexia in her class. Mm-hmm. She'd have a kid in for 2 weeks and said, we need to have this kid tested.
There was no access to testing for Zuzu. I had to go find it.
Wow.
I had to go all the way to a neuropsychologist for her to be properly diagnosed as dyslexic.
You should have had her at Parkview. That's where my wife taught. Our next door neighbor's child was private schooled, struggling mm-hmm. with reading, fourth grade, comes into Jamie's class. She has him for 2 weeks and says he needs to be tested. He's dyslexic.
No, they knew something was wrong, but they just like these were like the most veteran teachers.
Wow.
And the protocol was just to put her in a reading circle out in the pod and have her keep reading out loud, and it was doing nothing to help her.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was
heartbreaking.
A very, very dark time. But no, I had to like, I was working at OU at the time, and I was like, surely there's a professor in the College of Education that deals with special education.
Mm-hmm.
So I cold emailed someone there, and that's what started like the rabbit hole that I went down to find the pain center, which I'm sure your wife knows about. Yeah.
Both of us do. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And so but all this to say is like that nuance wasn't there in this like Reading Sufficiency Act. I'm sure there's, you know, I kind of wonder if Charles McCall was still in the legislature, how he would feel about this just because of his personal experience. But anyways, the expertise is not there. They're rewarding people who don't have expertise. I'm not trying to get us off on a tangent too far, but, you know, but instead we have these, like, I don't know. I'm just thinking of like the new agency head at the College of or the Department of Education, right? Like he came from career tech. So that's much better than a lot of these other appointees. But that's also a whole other different system. That's a whole other system compared to, you know, K-12 writ large. So
his heart is in the right place, but you know, just having somebody who says the right things about teachers is not gonna move us from 49th to anything besides 49th.
No, not to mention the Mississippi Miracle, whatever it's called,
Mirage.
It seems to me part of the problem with all that, you know, there's just so many pieces to all this that for folks other than us who are keenly interested in the machinations of governance and public policy making and politics, how you bring it together in a way that the average person in Oklahoma can begin to sink their teeth into it and say, yeah, this we've headed down the wrong direction here. Here's what we should expect or what we should demand of our elected leaders to get done on our behalf. And you know, I don't know how you do that. I mean, people are, as you said, Annie, you know, prices are going through the roof here in Oklahoma. People are trying to keep a roof over their heads and food on the table and gas in their tanks.
I think you could start by saying, has your salary doubled in the past year? Because STITS agency heads kind of have.
With the acquiescence of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish I could tell you I knew what message would really resonate with people. I'm not a messaging person. It's something I've studied for 8 years now. And so I'm getting a little better at it maybe, but it's hard to break through. What's the old saying about you can't use reason to talk somebody out of where they are if they didn't use reason to get there. And a lot of this is a wall that's being built up by the kind of media that people are consuming. And there's not a message that I can give, I think, that will break through some of that other media messaging. I wish I could tell the folks who are going to listen to this that I had some great hope. But I struggle. I really do struggle because I think there's so many people who are perfectly fine with the way things are, even though it's not working for them. They don't know to expect any different. And that's heartbreaking.
That may be the real Oklahoma standard.
Yeah.
Right now.
I do want to sidebar on education real quick. I want to chase this rabbit. A couple of things. When I ran for office in 2018, actually started knocking doors in 2017, I talked a lot about education, smaller class sizes, better teacher pay, more resources, better textbooks, curriculum, et cetera. The things that we know matter in a classroom. Mm-hmm. I had just come off of being the president of the Middell Public Schools Foundation Board of Trustees. We spent 4 years of just horrendous cuts to education funding. And here we were trying to backfill those dollars with private donor dollars as best we could. I have since moved away from that message of all of those things. While they still matter, I firmly believe if we had small class sizes, great teachers, curriculum, et cetera, we would still be bottom 10 in the United States because of what's happening outside the classroom. Kids are growing up in an environment in Oklahoma that is just toxic, and they bring that toxicity to the classroom with them. The behaviors, the challenges, we have so many kids who are not being fed correctly at home, clothed correctly at home. Parents aren't making them go to bed at a decent time at night. If the parents are home, and this isn't necessarily a shot at parents directly, because there's lots of parents who are working extra hours, just trying to make sure that they're trying to pay the bills as best they can. But you want a kid to learn to love to read? How do they do that? It starts with their very first teacher, their mom or dad at home, who puts them in their lap and reads to them and shows them love by reading to them. That's what, in my mind, creates people who love to read. They experienced love that way. And that's not happening today. So you have these kids who come to school with these backpacks filled with trauma, ill-prepared to learn, and teachers are spending their time meeting kids where they are instead of teaching. So if I had a magic wand to wave and I wanted to fix education in Oklahoma, I would be pointing that wand outside the classroom, mental health support, substance abuse treatment services, the things I think that would really make a difference. And I will add to that, I have discovered as a capitalist how much, you get that age-old question, well, how much should we be spending on education? How much is enough, right? Well, I have an answer from a capitalist perspective. I took a look at the private schools in my district. I've got Christian Heritage in my district. It costs $16,000 for a student to attend Christian Heritage. Tuition. That doesn't cover transportation. It doesn't cover curriculum. It doesn't cover food. It doesn't cover the cost of the buildings. $16,000. In Oklahoma, we spend $12,000. So Christian Heritage, and I think Christian Heritage is doing a good job of educating students, but the students that they educate are some of our easiest to educate. Two-parent households, not worried about food on the table, right? Their parents have time in their schedules to drop them off at school when they're young. They drive themselves to school. You got a parking lot filled with cars over there, which are families that have enough money that they can afford not just the vehicle, but the insurance for a young person to drive these days. and it cost them $16,000 to educate a kid. So in my mind, it's at least $16,000 per student that we ought to be spending as a state if we want to provide a truly meaningful education for our kids.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good place to start.
I think I may have left you speechless.
No,
I'm just processing.
No, yeah. You know, the old line, how do you eat an elephant? It's one bite at a time. And there's just so much, you're right, mental health, public health, making sure that we're addressing hunger issues. It seems like if we had visionary leadership, we would have people at the top who are saying, this is what we're going to focus on and why and where we're going. And we're going to get there by getting it up to $16,000 or whatever the number is per student. We're going to increase mental health programs and access and make it easier. We're going to deal with hunger. We're going to, you know, all these sorts of things. It seems like there are four or five things like that that you could really focus on. But instead, I'm afraid a lot
instead
of our...
Instead of we're picking a fight with OSSAA.
Yes,
exactly. That was the governor's big policy choice. And he wants to re-vote on marijuana. Like, this man did not choose...
There was
major policy issues. He did
not choose visionary there at all.
He did not choose any policy choices for his last year in office that would improve the lives of Oklahomans. Everyone who's running to replace him is doing the exact same thing.
Certainly on the Republican side of the aisle. I go back 4 years though, right? And I wish Joy Hofmeister had picked up this message. Kevin Stitt was talking about, you know, how he had done all the amazing things in Oklahoma. He created a grand total of 40,000 jobs in his first 4 years in office. That's it. 40,000 jobs. Do you know how many jobs were created by medical marijuana? 50,000. He only netted 10 or no, a negative 10, right?
No, but he has chosen no major, like, you know, the saying is your life better now than it was 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, he constantly beat the drums. We're going to make Oklahoma top 10. Oklahoma's bottom 10.
Yes.
In just about everything. And what you see here is in his world and in the way that he operates, people fail up.
Yeah.
Yes. Because Shelley Zumwalt would still have a job in his administration.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because Dave Ostro has a job again in his administration.
Yeah.
Dino DeMarco has come back around.
Like, is he? Where is he?
I've just heard his name again, and I'm drawing a blank, and I could have made that up, but I'm pretty sure I heard his name again. But Dave freaking Ostro is back on the scene.
Gino DeMarco, you know, should be in jail with the work that he did in the whole Swadley's situation.
Exactly. Not to mention
the COVID dollars
stuff. Yes.
Yeah.
Like, Ryan Walters didn't leave because he was thrown out. Right. Like, I mean, these people are all coming back again. So I'm just disgusted with this idea that Stitt is not at all responsible for the lack of policy advancement in the 8 years that he's been governor. Nothing good has happened to this state since he's been governor.
Not just the lack of policy. I mean, the lack of advancement. You know, I was listening to Chad Warmington with the state chamber. Mm-hmm. He's talking about, you know, how the education's an issue and we're 49th and, you know, we're last in our athletic conference. And if we were a football team, you know, we'd be firing our coach, right? Well, he also pointed out, let slip in the presentation I saw, that we are dead last in our region in economic development productivity.
Yes.
Over the last decade. Well, maybe Yes. We should be firing our coach in the executive mansion here in the state of Oklahoma, except he never actually lives there.
And the thing is like the state chamber, and you know this, Andy, because I know you go to the breakfast and stuff, but the state chamber has been sounding the alarm I mean, they elect these people, but they've also been sounding the alarm with the people they bring in. Like, I was at a luncheon a long time ago, 10 years ago, where like the commanding officer at Tinker was like, we can't get the skilled labor that we need in the state of Oklahoma. We can't get the engineers, the technicians, the skilled labor that we need. Like just from a national defense perspective, but from like the skilled jobs. And I'm not talking about the trades, right? I'm just like the engineer, the college education level, professional trades. We can't get them in Oklahoma. We have landed no new corporations in the state, right? Like we've seen people leave. Our skyline is eroding in Oklahoma City.
We're going to put 1.8 million square feet of Class A premium office space on the market because Devin went to Texas.
I
The
went
governor.
back.
The governor likes to crow about how he's building the best business, best place to do business in the United States, right here in Oklahoma. And we lost two more Fortune 500 companies' headquarters.
So I'm just going to ask you, I guess John Budd was at Sonic before he was at OMES or whatever, but I'm like, so if you have this same rotation of, thought leaders or whatever running your government, why is it so bad? Right? John Budd's now at Commerce. Like, okay, so what are we going to do with that? So I don't know. I'm just utterly disgusted with this governor because he's a joker. He's an absolute joke. I wrote about this for the Observer, just for those who don't know, but it infuriates me how little he has done for this state since he's been in office. And he couldn't even acknowledge, I mean, he couldn't even make it his platform for the year to improve upon what he's done, right? And I'm sorry, Andy, it just makes me so mad. So he picked a fight with OSSA. Hey, who cares? Who cares?
I did make a social media post the day before the governor's state of the state that was based on Groundhog Day, the movie.
Yes.
Just poking fun at the state of the state. And we're going to hear the exact same things we've heard for the last 7 years, blah, 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 blah. And nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed. He's even got Donnell Carter working with him again. And I'm like, and it's just like, it's the same group of people that got him into office. It's the same exact same people that he put into place when he took office in 2019. And nothing has gotten better because of them.
It has gotten worse, though. When he was elected, and we were elected together. I don't know how much of the blame I can take for this, but
None.
the
Zero.
state of Oklahoma was ranked 38th in poverty. Today it's 45th. We've
Jesus.
lost a place every single year under Kevin Stitt.
And see, Andy, when you talk about, like not being able to teach the kids in school, I'm like, it's, this, it's the home, right? It's the home. But we have a government that's a state government and really a federal government now that's absolutely incapable of seeing itself playing a role in making people's lives better. And people, poverty is a choice. Poverty is a policy choice by our government. We have chosen as a society to let our social safety net and our care for one another completely go to the wayside. So that's why we've seen our poverty absolutely go. And Stitt has done nothing about it. He's making health care harder. The federal government's going to make it even worse, with Medicaid, the big beautiful bill. But he has completely, and I'm going to say, there's a direct connection, I would say, to the fact that he's put those people in place at the state agencies that, that are in charge of our safety net here in Oklahoma, for what, for as small as it may be, between their incompetence and their lack of knowledge and skill in these certain areas. Justin Brown at DHS, the cast of characters that have gone through the health department, and the people at, ODMH, the people at OHCA, right? Like there's a direct connection between the lack of leadership and the lack of skill and policy chops at all of these agencies and where we are today.
DMH is a good example of that.
Yes.
And he doubled down on the director there. And if the legislature had not been smart in when we rewrote that statute and given ourselves a Trump card,
right,
where we had the ability to remove directly, she would still be there, still not knowing how much money they had, didn't have, you know. So there's an underlying current that I think we all need to understand, as it relates to the social safety net. I think this fits Oklahoma thinking. People don't want to be taken advantage of. And there's this prevailing belief that many are taking advantage of the systems that are in place today. And that's why there's a pushback on the social safety net. And some of that, I think, goes to what you were talking about, Marianne, with, you know, putting people in charge who don't seem to be making good decisions, don't seem to be.
And we've got freaking hucksters in charge, you know,
yeah.
Like.
Yeah. But I think it predates all of that. And
I don't know. I mean, we all collectively know who the agency leaders were pre 2019, right? Like,
I'm thinking historically decades, not just, you know, the last, I think it goes back to the Ronald Reagan, you know, what's the line from Reagan? I'm here from
Worst thing you can hear is that I'm from the government. I'm here to help you.
Yeah, non-scariest exactly. Words in the English language.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I think historically, at least since I've been alive, right? Like, you know, I'm a child of House Bill 1017.
Yeah.
Right. That was the education bill, right? In the early 90s.
Uh-huh.
I was for some reason I was worried. I was thinking about my dissertation bill. Anyways, you know, I remember when my teachers were out of the classroom for that.
Yeah.
In fifth grade, I remember when my teachers marched for that. But then I think there was a willingness from the state government that harkens back to our roots as a state to try and do better. Right. Well, really try and work on things. That's why we saw the creation of the healthcare authority, because it needed to be its own thing. You know, we saw.
Well, Lloyd Rader.
Huh?
Lloyd Rader, you know, was a significant part of why that is the way it is today.
And David Walkers, we talked to him for like our very first, like one yeah. of our, wasn't he? One of our first episodes yes. of the podcast. But there was this willingness to take on these big issues. They didn't always get it right.
It's not just a willingness. It is the institutional knowledge to be able to do this.
Yes.
And this is going to be very pejorative against my colleagues and myself. And it's not really intended to be a slap, but we don't know enough to really, really do meaningful things at the Capitol in very many places.
Thank you, term limits.
Yes. You know, right. You were talking about 1017. I was part of the very first cohort for gifted and talented here in the state of Oklahoma, courtesy of Jim Howell in Midwest City.
Yeah,
I was researching.
Gifted and talented in Middell schools were some of the best things in the whole world.
Yeah.
Changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was researching a piece of policy 2 weeks ago for the Appropriations and Budget Committee. We were allocating some money to the Economic Development Authority here in the state of Oklahoma. I'm thinking, man, this is really smart. I like the way this is set up. We're using state dollars to help bring down the loan rates, interest rates for private businesses in places where we have what we believe a vested economic interest in doing that development. Doesn't put the state at risk. The statute goes all the way back to the early 1970s. And it's those kinds of things. I think, man, this is really smart the way we structured this. And I struggle to identify those things that we're doing today where I could say, man, this is really smart the way we structured this.
Well, and people are going to think this is a highly partisan analysis from me, although, you know, they probably expect that anyway, I suppose. But it's a progressive point of view in my mind. But I can't be, and I don't think any of us can be, totally surprised that this is where we are given who we're electing at this time. And you have in Kevin Stitt, a guy who, you know, made a lot of money, apparently, I guess, in the mortgage business, who the mansion is not fit to his standards, so he lives in Oak Tree. His kids go to private schools. The cast of characters running to replace him on the Republican side Gettner Drummond comes from a loaded family. Charles McCall comes from a loaded family. A guy like Mike Mazie is one of the, you know, one of the premier wealth managers in the country. I mean, you just start down this list of things. And you contrast that, I think, to Cindy Munson, who actually, you know, is an incredibly accomplished person who rose above her circumstances, unhoused on many occasions as a child, who was an Oklahoma's promise kid, who took advantage of some forward visionary thinking with the creation of that program, earned a bachelor's degree, went to the University of Nebraska and got a master's degree. The contrast couldn't be clearer to me for average Oklahomans. Do you want to continue the folks who have no real idea what it's like where the rubber meets the road for the average working person in Oklahoma, or somebody like Cindy Munson, you want somebody who pulled themselves up by their bootstraps? You know, it seems to me that she did. And I just think if we continue to elect folks who are so out of touch with, you know, oh, how am I going to pay the electric bill this month? Or, oh my God, if they add another penny or two to my sales tax, I don't know how I'm going to continue to afford milk and.
Can't do that. We don't have pennies anymore.
Well, I know. Yeah, I guess you're right. Okay.
There's a piece of this, I think, where I don't know if this is Oklahoma or if it's more pervasive nationwide, but it's the embrace the aura of success mentality. We look at these people and say, oh, they're independently wealthy. They must be successful because of virtue or because, you know, in Kevin
they just
Stitt's
work
case.
There. Yeah. They just work to get themselves there.
Yeah. In Kevin Stitt's case, I think you had somebody who was a sharp operator who found a niche where he could leverage kind of the looseness in federal law to make lots of money. You know, I don't know about Mike Mazie and Gettner Drummond, you know, you could point back to
welfare.
You could point back to, you know, the Killers of the Flower Moon and kind of the eye opening for me. And I'm not pointing direct fingers at Gettner Drummond. You know, I don't want anybody to take that, but that kind of thing. Mark Wayne Mullen, you know, the aura of success. The dude was born with a silver pipe wrench in his mouth. And
Yeah. No, I think I remember someone saying after Sit was elected and they're like, well, he's a millionaire. He must be smart.
Yeah.
I was like, did you listen to the words coming out of his mouth?
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. Yeah.
The aura of success.
Yeah.
Which is probably why we have the president we have today. But that's a whole other episode. That's a lot of episodes, but yeah.
We all assume that all of these people are following some kind of Horatio Alger story, you know, rags to riches. And that's just not the case.
No. I'm also going to say there's something to be said for being a at all good looking white dude in this society that just makes it so much easier to fail upward than it would be for like someone like me or even Cindy Munson, right? Like you can't quite be a battle axe as a woman, like you can't even be a total moron as a white man and get ahead. So sorry, had to say it as the woman on the podcast. So yeah.
We're with you.
Uh-huh.
So
we're with you on that one.
Well, guys, this was fun.
Thanks for having me.
Kind of depressing, but this was fun. It's always fun. So, Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. Let's see, is deadline week this coming week or was it this past week?
Just
the first major committee deadline was this week. So
okay,
we've now
so
got 3 weeks.
Week.
Well, we've got 3 weeks ahead of us now of floor work. So we've got 2 full weeks and then the shortened spring break week. And
so
then
change that calendar a little bit. Okay.
Yeah. Instead of 4 weeks, we're now 5 weeks. For the first, as each chamber is doing its own homework. And then we discovered that spring break was kind of a pain as, you know,
yeah, it shut
it's
down.
Part of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's why we wind up with three weeks worth of floor work. So instead of a 6-week calendar, it's now an 8-week calendar. But when we swap and begin grading the Senate's homework, then we abbreviate the schedule again. So I think that's 5 weeks, effectively.
So this means you're going to have all the time in the world to do it right. There's not going to be any midnight bills.
There won't be any midnight bills because we want to do 50 bills in 50 minutes.
Oh my God.
How's that for meaningful, substantive, deliberate, you know, that's the A and B process. That one committee is so perfunctory. It's just, yeah.
And so we wonder why we have an agency making $300,000, but whatever.
Yeah. And crisis pregnancy, getting a $2 million supplement, and they can't tell us how the money was spent. And they won't. And, you know,
the thing. Oh, that's a bad thing.
Oklahoma Pregnancy Care Network, right, is ostensibly a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
So nonprofits, what do? They go out and they raise money for a cause, right? You go look at their 990s, you don't see any money coming from any donors other than the taxpayers. You go to their website, you can't find a list of their donors. They don't even have their executive director listed out there, nor do they have their board members listed anymore. What kind of nonprofit, you know?
So I'm going to tell you, in the day and age of Jeffrey Epstein, people dealing with orphans and unaccompanied kids just creeps me out.
Yeah.
That's really, really scary what they're doing with those women and their children.
Well, it's
left to me.
So this is mid-level. Remember, there's another level below. All we do is give money to this group. Then they decide how to allocate that money.
Yeah. Yeah, that's bad news. That's scary bit.
So there's zero accountability for those organizations below them that are the ones who are supposed to be actually providing services to women.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, have a good Sunday or Saturday afternoon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.